listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As the U.S. media continues stoking tensions between the Trump administration and Iran, Russia and China said that they would stand with Tehran against any attempt to undo the nuclear deal cut with the P5 plus one countries during the Obama administration. Press TV's Hamid Kalaj has more.
U.S. President Donald Trump on January 12th reluctantly agreed to waive sanctions against Iran that were lifted as part of the landmark nuclear deal, but said it would be the last time he issued such a waiver unless conditions were met. Trump had given his European allies a May 12th deadline to fix what he said the terrible flaws of the agreement, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. The U.S. president has once again renewed his threats against Iran during a meeting with his visiting French counterpart.
But the Iranians say they'll restart their nuclear program.
We'll find out. You'll find out about that. It won't be so easy for them to restart. They're not going to be restarting anything. They restart it, they're going to have big problems, bigger than they've ever had before. And you can mark it down. They restart their nuclear program, they will have bigger problems than they have ever had before.
Emmanuel Macron, later in a joint press conference with Trump, said Paris is looking forward to working on a new deal with Tehran.
We have nuclear on the short run, we have nuclear on the long run, we have ballistic activity, we have regional presence of Iran. We want to fix the situation for these four pillars. Syria is part of the fourth one. And what we have to work on, obviously with Iran and the different parties in the region, the P5 and our allies, is to find a fair deal where we can fix the overall situation.
Iran has on several occasions ruled out the possibility of renegotiating the nuclear agreement. President Hassan Rouhani on Tuesday issued a stern warning about the consequences of scuttling the deal.
We're sticking to our commitments more strongly than ever, but if anyone wants to betray our nation or our deal, they should know that grave consequences would affect them. The Iranian people and government have planned for all scenarios to face them.
The secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has also warned that Tehran may decide to quit the nuclear non-proliferation treaty should Washington ditch the deal.
Unfortunately, from the first day that the other party was supposed to fulfill its commitment, there were obstructions in different forms, and during Trump's presidency, this has reached its climax. In NPT, the signatories have the right to simply withdraw if they feel their national interest is not being served by staying in NPT. This is one of the options for the Islamic Republic of Iran out of the three different options.
Russia and China, both of whom are signatories to the deal, have vowed to leave no stone unturned to block any attempt by the U.S. to sabotage their accord. They have also called on the U.N. to back a draft statement to save the deal. Trump's stance against internationally recognized agreements has dented the United States' already damaged credibility. Scrapping the nuclear deal will for certain test the U.S. reliability.
On Tuesday, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, was in New York, and he laid out the situation that exists currently, in his view, between the U.S. and Iran.
Our region is in dire need of a change. We have seen many conflicts in this region. After the revolution, we were faced with an aggression, use of chemical weapons, followed by situation in Afghanistan, situation between Iraq and Kuwait, situation in Syria, again situation in Iraq, and now the heartbreaking situation in Yemen, where 1 million people are dying from cholera. And much of it is because of anxieties, concerns. Most anxieties and concerns of one of our neighbors about us, which have become almost an obsession. During the Iran-Iraq war, most of you remember when Saddam Hussein started attacking Iranian ships. Now, I don't want to talk about using chemical weapons against Iran. All of you know about that. And since his closest ally, Kuwait, was selling oil for him, and he didn't have many ships in the Persian Gulf, and we wanted to retaliate, so Iranian armed forces started attacking Kuwaiti ships. You remember the Kuwaiti reflagging operation and all of that. As a young diplomat, very young diplomat, I drafted a letter to the Secretary General of the United Nations, which was then signed by our then foreign minister, my boss, Dr. Velayati, asking the Secretary General of the United Nations to see if he could make regional arrangements in order to avoid the widening of the conflict in the Persian Gulf. That letter later became, this is 1985-86, that letter later became the basis for paragraph 8 in Security Council Resolution 598, which ended the Iran-Iraq war. That paragraph called for, asked the Secretary General to envisage regional arrangements between the littoral states of the Persian Gulf to prevent the widening of the conflict and to prevent further escalation. There was another paragraph, paragraph 5, asking all countries, that meant including the United States, to avoid actions that would further escalate the conflict. Well, we started implementing Resolution 598, paragraphs about ceasefire, withdrawal, even the paragraph that called on the Secretary General to look into the causes for the initiation of the conflict, and the Secretary General later came up with the report saying what everybody already knew, that Iraq had started the war for 8 years, which caused a lot of destruction, but unfortunately, which was a situation where the international community helped the aggressor almost entirely. But the Secretary General never got to paragraph 8, because countries in the region were not that comfortable. In 2 years' time, we ended the Iran-Iraq war in 1988. 2 years' time, Saddam Hussein turned his guns, actually turned their guns, because they had bought all of it for him, against the countries who had provided him with those arms. Kuwait was the primary target. That was not the end of his ambitions. In a message that he sent us, he told us that we are going to have 1,200 kilometers of borders in the Persian Gulf, meaning that he was planning to take over the entire region. And we said at that time, had the Secretary General started implementing paragraph 8 of Resolution 598, we might not be here. We have seen many other catastrophes in our region, starting with that second war. You all call it first Persian Gulf War. For us, it's a second Persian Gulf War, because we had gone through the first Persian Gulf War for 8 years. Your first, second, occupation of Kuwait, liberation of Iraq, then pushing Saddam out of office. All of these happened. A lot of extremism. We had predicted that the third or fourth Persian Gulf War would only lead to further extremism. People did not listen. And now we are facing the situation that we're facing. We believe we need to break this cycle and start anew. How do we do that? We believe in our region we suffer from dialogue deficit. We don't talk to each other. We talk a lot about each other, particularly when we come here. Our neighbors, particularly Saudi Arabia, wants to create an impression that we are an existential threat against them. You just saw a very expensive 2-week tour of the United States, and that was one of the most important messages that wanted to be presented. We need to address, first and foremost, the dialogue deficit. That is why we have suggested in a number of op-eds that I've written, as well as in other presentations, a regional dialogue forum. Something that we should have done in 1988, if not before that. We have the institutional basis for that regional dialogue forum already. A Security Council resolution under Chapter 7 provides for even a United Nations role as an umbrella. Because there are disparities in size and power, and those disparities in size and power would always lead to countries' anxieties. And not all of it is about Iran, just ask Qatar. So these disparities need to be addressed one way or the other, and we believe that this umbrella that the United Nations under paragraph 8 of Resolution 598 provides, Chapter 7 resolution, can assure the smaller states that you don't need to be swallowed by your bigger neighbors, that there is an umbrella of what our Arab friends call international legitimacy, meaning the United Nations. In order to enter this regional dialogue forum, because we are used to this enemy paradigm, the paradigm of exclusion. We need to break away from that paradigm. And we need to provide an environment where we can include everybody. Now, there are 8 states in the Persian Gulf area, the GCC countries, plus Iran and Iraq, and probably even Yemen. Unfortunate situation as it may be, it will not last forever. How they get in? Simple. They need to accept a certain number of principles. As I will talk, you, those of you who have followed Europe, will tell me that you're talking about the Helsinki process. But I'm talking about a process that will be genuinely a Persian Gulf process. A number of principles that we need to accept. Principles should include respect for sovereignty, territorial integrity, inviolability of international borders. You know, countries in the region, if you look at the southern states of the Persian Gulf, they all have territorial claims against one another, and Saudi Arabia probably against all of them. So, inviolability of international borders may sound rather primitive, but it is an extremely important principle. Non-intervention in the internal affairs of each other. We are being accused of intervening. Accused. There are cases of their intervening in our internal affairs. We did not claim that we will take the war into Saudi Arabian territory, but the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia did make that official claim. So if people think we're afraid of talking about the region, no, there is a lot to talk about the region. We simply decided not to deal with it on the when we were discussing the nuclear issue, but there is a lot to ask on the Iranian side about what's happening in our region. So inviolability of border, respect for sovereignty, territorial integrity, non-intervention in the internal affairs of each other, these would constitute the set of principles that in the Helsinki process was used to be called ticket principles. Accepting these principles would constitute the necessary ticket to get into the regional dialogue forum. Then we need to deal with, in addition to just talking to each other at the formal and informal level, we need to deal with the confidence deficit. We have a dialogue deficit and we have a confidence deficit. So we can start talking, working on confidence building measures. Confidence building measures can include joint task forces on issues ranging from nuclear safety, because as you know, Persian Gulf, the literal states of the Persian Gulf, the coast of the Persian Gulf are going to be hosts to a growing number of nuclear reactors. So concerns about nuclear safety in the Persian Gulf may not be serious, but it may be very soon. To tourism, cultural exchange, all sorts of stuff. Women empowerment, democratic processes, however alien that might be to some. We can discuss, we can have common working groups, task forces dealing with these issues to enable us to talk to one another and to enable us to share experience with each other and to enable us to move away from the current situation of simply coming here and talking to you rather than talking to one another. In order to make this transformation, we hear in the United States a lot about transformational figures. Now let's really do transformation. In order to make a serious transformation, we need to recognize a number of principles in addition to those ticket principles. For us, I mean, these are very simple realities. First, era of zero-sum games, long over. In this world, there can be no winners and losers. We experienced that during the nuclear discussions. Nobody won when we were trying to up the ante against one another, and maybe soon again. in the nuclear file. When the United States wanted zero centrifuge option, we went from 200 centrifuges to 20,000 centrifuges. So the United States got a net total of 19,800 centrifuges. And we also went from a plus 7 growth to a minus 7 growth. So everybody loses. In a war, there are no winners. Only in the wars of the Middle Ages you could have winners and losers. In the wars of 20th and 21st century, there are no winners. Only the degree and amount of loss will be different. Somebody may lose 100,000 people, somebody else may lose 10,000 people. Somebody may suffer billions upon billions of devastation. Somebody like the United States may spend $7 trillion, according to President Trump, and get nowhere. Everybody loses in a war. In the globalized era, where even emotions are globalized, you cannot have security at the expense of insecurity of others. That's an important understanding. Second understanding, you cannot buy security. In billions upon billions of beautiful military equipment doesn't bring anybody security. Just look at the region. Now, some of our neighbors are coming here trying to compete with one another in buying more weapons in order to attract support and help against the other neighbor who's also buying billions of dollars from me. Security cannot be purchased. Security requires understanding in the region. And something which is most important to realize. The era of hegemonic influence is long gone. I'm not talking about the United States. The United States did try. After the Cold War, all the way, I mean, first Iraq War, you remember New World Order, then New American Century, all of that didn't work. I'm talking about our region. Neither Iran nor Saudi Arabia can be the hegemons of the region. That's a fact. We need to realize and appreciate this fact, however heartbreaking it may be. None of us can become this new hegemon. So, to put it, I mean, in a nice way, not to be offended by each other, let's put it this way. We need to have a strong region, not to be the strongest in the region. In an attempt to be the strongest in the region, to exclude one another from the region, we have managed to destroy the region. Time to break with that. And I'm telling you that Iran is ready for it because we are big enough, old enough, mature enough to appreciate this reality. And I hope that our neighbors can also appreciate it. And I hope other governments would help them in this process of transformation. That is the real transformational change in our region. And I believe unless we make this transformational change, no matter how much weapons the United States will sell to these countries, at the end of the day, the cost for the United States will be much higher than the profits made by the weapons sold. Thank you very much.
Meanwhile, the U.S. president met with France's President Macron in Washington, D.C., and they discussed both the situation with Iran and the war in Syria. RT's Caleb Maupin has more.
Well, it was certainly a colorful welcome given to the French president at the White House. However, the charm offensive didn't go exactly as many thought possibly was planned. Now, the French president stuck to his rhetoric about the USA being a guarantor of contemporary multilateralism. But when he brought that up, Donald Trump didn't seem quite receptive to those words. This is Trump and Macron.
We finished at least almost our work with respect to ISIS in Syria, ISIS in Iraq, and we have done a job that nobody has been able to do.
In Syria, we are together, engaged within the international coalition against ISIL terrorists, and we will continue to act within this framework until the end, until victory. That being said, in the long run, we need to bring peace and make sure that Syria does not become an enemy in the region.
Now, earlier, we've heard Macron bragging, saying that he was responsible for convincing Donald Trump not to remove U.S. military forces from Syria. However, Donald Trump does not agree with that narrative of events. Let's take a listen.
As far as Syria is concerned, I would love to get out. I'd love to bring our incredible warriors back home. They've done a great job.
Now, when it came to the Iran deal, just an hour before the press conference, Donald Trump and the French president, they were both very adamant in their positions. Trump was, at that point, saying what he said for a long time, which is opposition to the P5 plus one conclusion in the nuclear deal, whereas Macron was saying that there was no good plan B and that they needed to stick to the nuclear deal. This is what they were saying prior to today's meeting.
Thank you very much, Mr. President.
People know my views on the Iran deal. It was a terrible deal. It should have never, ever been made. We could have made a good deal or a reasonable deal. The Iran deal is a terrible deal.
We have to take it as a part of a broader picture,
sure,
which is security in the overall region.
It's insane. It's ridiculous. It should have never been made. But we will be talking about it.
What we want to do is to contain the Iranian presence in the region, and JCPOA is part of this broader picture.
They're not going to be restarting anything. They restart it, they're going to have big problems, bigger than they've ever had before. And you can mark it down. They restart their nuclear program, they will have bigger problems than they have ever had before.
But just an hour after sitting down with the Donald, it seems that Macron has changed his tune somewhat. This is Macron after meeting with Trump.
For a number of months, I've been saying that this was not a sufficient deal, but it will enable us, at least until 2025, to have some control over their nuclear activities. We therefore wish to work on a new deal with Iran.
Mr. President, you were saying that there was no plan B, that Iran deal was to be preserved. Now you're talking about a new deal with Iran. Why did you change your mind?
When I said there was no plan B, I usually refer to the fact there is no planet B. It was about climate change rather than Iran.
What do you have as a better option? I don't see it. What is the what-if scenario? Or your plan B? I don't have any plan B for nuclear against Iran.
Well, the U.S. State Department has a history of judging the human rights records of other countries. Washington itself comes under scrutiny as well. China has lambasted the U.S. for its human rights record, particularly with respect to race. Press TV's Connie Fatima.
China has lambasted the United States for hypocrisy and rights problems such as racism and political scandals. In its annual rebuttal to the criticism of Washington, China's State Council says the United States hurls abuse at other countries with its falsehoods. The Chinese Council says the U.S. human rights record is notorious for misdeeds and continues to worsen. According to a report by the Xinhua News Agency, African Americans are seven times more likely to be mistakenly jailed for murder. And violent crimes in the U.S. also keep rising. The report also mentioned serious abuses in the U.S. style of democracy. Beijing has been successful in lifting millions of Chinese out of poverty and raising the standard of living in the country. Joining us via Skype from New York is Margaret Kimberly, activist and political commentator.
The United States has more people and more of its population in prison than any other country, more than 2 million people. And half of those people are black. One quarter of all the people imprisoned on Earth are Black Americans. We have the problem of police murder. The police kill three people every single day in this country. So we have a situation where of state violence that is sanctioned, that goes unpunished, that is in fact quite embedded in the political culture, in the economy. We have a country where half the population is poor. Americans are getting poorer. Half the population makes less than $31,000 a year, which is a small sum of money for this economy. So we have increased inequality, increased poverty, a never-ending pattern of state violence. And of course, we have to mention the state violence that is committed against the rest of the world, with the United States having a huge military budget, assaulting, invading, intervening in other countries, causing chaos and death all over the world, using proxies to fight wars, using sanctions as war by other means, causing hunger and suffering. So the United States is responsible for very, very serious human rights abuses at home and abroad.
Right. So when we when we speak about this state violence, be it at home or abroad, why is it that successive U.S. governments have felt these don't amount to as serious in nature as those of other countries' human rights records, which have resulted in the U.S., as you pointed out, bombing them, waging wars against them, or even sanctioning them?
Well, it's hypocrisy. It's a matter of it's projecting onto other people. It's a way to get buy-in from the public. If you attack someone else, if you demonize another country, if you tell people that some other leader somewhere else in the world is evil, then you get buy-in. And people are willing to go along, unfortunately, willing to go along with the violence that impacts people around the world. We've seen this in Syria. We're constantly told that President Assad is a war criminal, but the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who is actually waging a genocide in Yemen, who has friends here, is never criticized at all by these same establishment figures or by the corporate media.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. After 68 years, the two Koreas are on the verge of signing a peace treaty. A Donald Trump-Kim Jong-un summit is in the works. Is peace coming to the Korean Peninsula? Well, it's possible. The foreign policy blob and the corporatist media are less enthusiastic. After all, conflict is their business model. Crosstalking the Korean Peninsula, I'm joined by my guest, Saurabh Gupta in Washington. He is a senior fellow at the Institute for China-America Studies. Also in Washington, we have John Merrill. He is former chief of the Northeast Asia Division of the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at the U.S. State Department, as well as author of Korea, The Peninsular Origins of the War. And in New York, we cross to Daniel Lazar. He is an author and freelance journalist who writes frequently about the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and the U.S. Constitution. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Saurabh, let me go to you first in Washington. If you look at the mainstream media, and particularly the cable stations, all the focus on the Korean Peninsula is directed towards this summit that Trump may have with the North Korean leader. But really, I think it's what's more important is happening this week, and it's the two Koreas coming together. How does this change the situation on the peninsula if North Korea and South Korea can find some kind of meaningful, and let me stress, meaningful rapprochement? Go ahead in Washington.
Let me, in response to your question, lay out right away that the real credit for the situation, the opportunity that we have today is because of President Moon Jae-in in South Korea. You know, if we had the same old conservative South Korean government in place today, what would have happened is Kim Jong-un would have gone through with his condensed testing schedule. And then after that, he would have gone straight into his bunker, emerging from time to time with grave threats and snarly, gnarly threats to blow everything up. The fact of the matter is that Moon Jae-in is the person who has been able to tease Kim Jong-un out into the sunshine and has opened and shown him a pathway to global integration and as well as North-South reconciliation. Moon Jae-in, the South Korean progressive government, has led this process of reconciliation, which has dramatically altered the dynamics on the Korean Peninsula. Of course, the Olympics also have helped. And therefore, it is North and South, the extent that they lead the process, that they will drag the other parties along, including the United States. So the real credit lies with the peninsula parties.
Okay, John, let me go to you. More or less the same question here, because the dynamic changes considerably. If there is a peace between the two Koreas after 68 years, they start coming to some kind of defense and security measures that both can accept. Then regime change, as it were, that we hear so many people talking about in the Washington foreign policy blob, that kind of is taken off the table because that would not be in South Korea's interest. Go ahead, John, in Washington.
Right, Peter. Well, I think you overstated it a little bit. I do give President Moon a lot of credit, but I think the main credit, and I never thought I would say this,
I know
probably belongs to Donald Trump.
I knew you were going to say that.
this is the man who said he wanted nothing more than to sit down and have a hamburger with Kim Jong-un, and it looks like he's going to get his chance. Right now, they're apparently still CIA people, liaison people, behind in Pyongyang, at least according to the South Korean media. And people are hard at work, and Mr. Pompeo is the guy that's been running this, formerly from his post as CIA director, but hopefully in a few days as Secretary of State. So I think I would agree that President Moon deserves a lot of credit, and certainly with a progressive government, a lot of things are possible that weren't under past conservative regimes. But I think we have to give President Trump his due as well.
Sure.
And I just hope things go okay. It's a topsy-turvy world right
exactly.
now.
Exactly. And you know, and I'm very happy that this process is going on. Let me go to Daniel. I don't care who gets the credit. I think that is really low on the hierarchy of importance here. Getting peace on that peninsula where you have the most heavily armed border in the world after 68 years, the considerable American military presence is there. And the Chinese have come in ways that I think we'll find out in the future that were very constructive here. It's the result that counts, most importantly. Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, let me speak up for Kim Jong-un, who I think has played his cards extremely well. This is not a political endorsement of him by any means, but he is a very smart player.
Yep.
And he has done a very good job. He seized control of the opening. Seized the opening that that Trump accorded him, and has really run with it. And I think it's a pretty impressive performance.
Okay, let's go back to Washington. I think what's really important here, I mean, it's good to get down to really the details here because we have a denuclearized South Korea. Korean Peninsula. That means North and South. So that means that American nukes would not be allowed there. I mean, this is the kind of opening that I think the North Korean leader was looking for. He's looking for a grand bargain. And you know what, folks? He's been asking for a grand bargain for a while. And I think he had to go through all of the theatrics of the missiles and the launches and, you know, all of the heated rhetoric back and forth. This was the opening that he was looking for, and it was a South Korean leader that opened the door, and we got a nod from Donald Trump. I mean, we'll find out where it goes. So, you know, it really gets down to the details of what that means, because we know all along North Korea wants security guarantees. Maybe Russia and China can be guarantors of that. Go ahead, Sorop, in Washington.
Yeah, absolutely correct on that. I mean, the real devil is in the details in terms of how do you go about staging nuclearization in terms of how that process works out, the mechanics of that process. But you're absolutely correct on that point with regard to denuclearization, that it is not just a North Korean affair. It needs to be a peninsular affair. Let me throw out a useful principle which might be useful out here. Both in terms of denuclearization as well as in reduction of conventional forces in terms on the peninsula and in terms of the hostilities that are there. In terms of denuclearization, we're talking, of course, complete, verifiable, irreversible denuclearization of North Korea. They can have a civil nuclear program, which will be very intrusively watched over by the IAEA, full scope safeguards, etc., etc. But what that means for South Korea is that, of course, they have their very extensive civil nuclear program, but there will be no strategic forces on their territory, and there won't even be an extended deterrent to South Korea provided by the U.S. so long as there is complete denuclearization of the North. Now, the parallel fact which North and South Korea frankly need to work out, because denuclearization is essentially a topic of discussion between North Korea and the United States. With right. regard to conventional forces, what the disposition at the end of the day needs to be that the peninsula is kind of insulated from larger geopolitics of right. Northeast Asia. South Korea has already shown that it is not terribly interested in getting into things like a regional ballistic missile shield. Trilateral alliance.
We're going to find out just how far the Pentagon wants to go along with it. Sean, let me go to you. Because if you look at the mainstream media yeah. and the punditry that we were bombarded with all of the time, the mainstream media is really not on board here. Is it just because they don't want to see Trump succeed at anything, or in the military-industrial complex? I mean, South Korea and that region of the world is a nice trough for arms, and the U.S. has a vast military establishment there that needs to be paid for. I mean, right. is it a combination of these things here? Go ahead. John in Washington.
Well, you know, Peter, I don't know. That's kind of hard to say. What I will say is this. I think what has happened is that we have now gotten a de facto freeze for freeze. This was the proposal yep. that was made by Moscow and Beijing years ago. And I wrote an op-ed on this subject about a year and a half ago, and I got excoriated. Yeah. For saying that. But this is what is now de facto in place. And so this is a big deal.
It is a big deal.
You know, the U.S. military exercises this year, the joint U.S.-ROK exercises, are a shadow of their former self. Last year, we had three aircraft carrier battle groups participating. This year, it's one small aircraft. It's really an assault ship with short takeoff and landing F-35s. So it's a huge deal. Now, there are huge military asymmetries on the peninsula, which are going to be astronomically difficult to resolve. So we may get a start in these discussions. When the two Korean leaders meet, they may, in a few days, they may even declare an end to
yes.
the Korean War, at least hostilities. But it's going to take a lot of tough slogging to work through some of these details, and particularly to put in place the security guarantees, which I think the North Koreans are going to insist on to go forward.
Daniel, let me go to you. I mean, security guarantees, that's what it's always been about. And I'm glad that John mentioned the freeze for freeze, because that's been around for a while. Nobody in the mainstream media says that, where that idea comes from. But I can tell you, if you go to last year during the Security Council, you could see the Russian and the Chinese ambassador at length go through that process here. Daniel, before we go to the break, go ahead in New York.
Well, I just want to remind your viewers that in 2002, George W. Bush virtually declared war on North Korea, which he somehow blamed for 9/11. But North Korea was one of the three countries comprising the so-called Axis of Evil. And the U.S. Invaded one of those countries, has you know, has been sword rattling at the other ever since. And so North Korea had, you know, had grave concerns regarding its own security. So Kim Jong-un figured his only protection lay in a nuclear weapon, okay, which he has built.
And Daniel, he apparently has. Let me jump in here. Hold that thought. Gentlemen, we're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the Korean Peninsula. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Daniel in New York. You were taking us down history lane. You were just talking about the Axis of Evil. Yeah. But pick up from there. Go ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, well, so in 2002, with his Axis of Evil speech, George W. Bush essentially declared war on North Korea. And that speech has never been rescinded in any way. There's been no apology issued, no taking back, et cetera. So Kim Jong-un figured, quite logically, that his only protection lay in having a nuclear weapon capable of striking the United States mainland, which he apparently has achieved. So that is his great chess piece, his ace in the hole. And I don't think, I will go on a limb here, but I really doubt that he will agree to full denuclearization unless the U.S. meets him, you know, is willing to engage equally, in an equally grand gesture, which Trump might be willing to do, but I can guarantee the rest of the foreign policy establishment, or blob, as you call them, will not. They will raise holy hell, and they will essentially block Trump from doing that.
Sort of in Washington, go reflect upon that, because that's been my inkling from all along. You know, I'm like John said, I'm perfectly willing to give Donald Trump credit for this if this is, you know, kicked it off. Okay, fine. Okay, but there are forces, and you see it all the time, and the corporate media mimics their corporate owners. Okay, they're not keen on seeing peace breaking out, particularly if it means negotiations as equal. That's not in their DNA. They don't operate that way. Go ahead.
Absolutely, absolutely correct. First, let me back up a little bit out here and say that, yes, I totally agree with John that a huge amount of credit is also due to Donald Trump. Because let us remember, before he talked about fire and fury and destroying North Korea, he also probably went further than any U.S. president had talked about, and talked about particular some assurances. He doesn't seek the collapse of the North Korean regime. He doesn't seek regime change. He doesn't want to have an invasion over the 30th parallel, et cetera, et cetera. So he has tried. He had made a lot of assurances also in his early months, and he has not got adequate credit for that. So yes, I mean, in other ways also, Donald Trump deserves credit, and that's perfectly fine. You know, the one really good thing going for Donald Trump is that the U.S. system provides huge amount of power, not just to the presidency, but to the president. And so he can really override his staff, because, frankly, this is all going to come down to Donald Trump and making that deal with Kim Jong-un, which the foreign policy establishment has not been willing to contemplate. And part of the reason it's not been willing to contemplate, it's easy to say that, oh, the Kim regime forever, the Kims from their part are always cheating, et cetera, which is not entirely true. It is partly true, not entirely true. But just too many forces, I think, people in Washington are vested in a Cold War mindset, confrontational attitude to Northeast Asian geopolitics, with the 38th parallel being that tripwire. And it's not easy for many of them to come to terms The peninsula could be just insulated from that whole geopolitical environment.
Well, let's ask John, because John, that was his line of business for a while. I mean, what are the forces moving against this here? Beyond, because it's just Donald Trump's idea, but I mean, talk through the bureaucratic inertia that, you know, that would be against this. Go ahead.
Well, I think I would disagree. I think that currently the top leadership of the U.S. Defense Department is not against what Trump is trying to do. And we just saw that in Syria. We saw that DOD weighed in, and so we had symbolic strikes against Syria rather than the more far-reaching operation that some were advocating. So I think that we have to be a little bit careful here. Now, I would take this back even a little bit before the Axis of Evil speech. People forget that nuclear weapons were first deployed on the Korean Peninsula during the Eisenhower administration. And we had at one time 950 tactical nuclear weapons in Korea. This is now a decline. Well, we had 7,000 in Western Europe. President Bush the Elder, who's now ill in the hospital, was the one who decided to put an end to this kind of madness. And so we began withdrawing them. But, you know, you don't have to explain the nuclear issue in terms of the evil nature of the North Korean regime, although perhaps there's some of that can be part of the explanation. It's really an action-reaction sequence. And we took the initial action, and the North Koreans then responded to it. So I think the same dynamic can be used in the current circumstances in terms of confidence-building measures, and hopefully we can walk this back. I agree completely that having a progressive president in Seoul is a huge help. Yep. And I think China and Russia can also help. But I think it's going to be really difficult to unravel this knot which we've tied ourselves up in the peninsula, and these various asymmetries.
Okay, Daniel, this kind of leads to where I want to go on the program. I mean, I'm sure that there's a sense that if the U.S., and there's the perception of the U.S. backing down, the perception of the U.S. Involved in a diplomatic process that would be deemed as appeasement here, that would have a ricochet effect through all of the other entangling alliances the U.S. has in the Pacific. Is this part of the thinking there? Because as John said, you know, to untie this knot here, there's a huge ripple effect through the entire region. Go ahead, Daniel.
That's totally true, totally true. And there'll be a huge ripple effect in Washington as well, where all these countries have their interests, they have their ties, they have their, you know, their little, their alliances. Japan most particularly, yep. But Russia and China as well. So if the North may be playing a kind of a Vietnamese game where they're trying to, seek a closer alliance with the South in order to protect themselves against China. So therefore, that's certainly possible, and China could be getting nervous as well. And China has friends in Washington too.
And the Japanese wouldn't be very happy with a unified, strong, powerful Korean Peninsula. And so, you know, that they would their whole defense thinking would have to be rethought. Keep going, Daniel.
And Japan has tons of friends in Washington also. So I think you're going to see a huge ripple effect from the. Northeast Asia, you know, onto Washington D.C. as all sides sort of pile on, and you know, and Trump is on one hand, Trump has got great power as a U.S. president, but on the other hand, politically, he's very weak.
Yep.
He is really on the ropes. He's taking a ferocious pummeling. So so I don't know. I doubt very much that he'll be able to withstand these forces, and I think that he will. I'm pretty sure he is incapable of engaging in the same kind of grand gesture that Kim Jong-un is willing to engage in.
Yeah, well, let me go back to he won the presidency. He surprises us all the time. You know, maybe it'll work this time. I don't know. I mean, don't you think also it's just a mindset? I mean, North Korea is this cartoonish evil character, the axis of evil. I mean, it's so convenient. And there's so many people that have made entire careers out of demonizing. And I'm not siding with the North Koreans or its leadership. I don't do that kind of thing. I'm basically a realist when it comes to foreign policy. So, but I mean, don't you think that's part of the problem here is just changing minds, you know, taking a fresh look, and there's this really an amazing opportunity that we may never see again. Go ahead.
Oh, absolutely. This is as good an opportunity since the end of the Korean War in as since the end of the Korean War to have a peace regime on the peninsula, as well as since the denuclearization declaration and agreements of the early 1990s to do denuclearization. Let me go out a little bit on a limb out here and tell and make two points. You know, with regard to denuclearization, most people, and I totally agree, understand their views that, oh, this is going to be very difficult, close to impossible. He's not going to give it up. I'm one of those few, very tiny minority who believes that this is very doable and he can give it up. Because Kim Jong-un is not in the same position as Saddam Hussein Gaddafi.
That's why he developed it in the first place, to trade it away for security guarantees. It seems logical to me.
Exactly. And let me explain that point also. You know, what is a nuclear weapon? The purpose of a nuclear weapon is to cause unacceptable damage to the adversary. He already can do unacceptable damage to the adversary by trashing Seoul with his conventional guns. And therefore, a nuclear weapon over and above that is something that he can leverage and he can bargain, and which is exactly what he's doing. And therefore, I would say that this is doable. This is a great opportunity. But what we have to do also is, this cannot be a process which has strung out over many years and a decade, and it's action for action with 500 steps, which then breaks down after 20 steps. This has to be a big, grand bargain done in a truncated way in a defined time period. And I think it's doable.
Let me go to John. John, you're on the negotiating team for the United States. What would you tell your boss, Donald Trump, to do in 40 seconds? Go ahead.
Hey, what I would tell him to do is just have good vibes in the meeting. Apparently, that was the case when Pompeo went there. I think what's different this time around is that the negotiations are not being run through a bureaucratic process. And a lot of people are criticizing Trump on this score. It's a crisis situation. People forget what we were talking about last fall. We were talking about the imminent prospect of war on the peninsula. So I think things are moving in a good direction. I am concerned about the asymmetries. Also, we're going to have one possible dropout in this process. Prime Minister Abe is in deep political trouble. Yeah. I'm not sure if he's going to be able to survive or not. But I think we just have to hope that the inter-Korean summit goes well.
Okay.
And that in a way, Moon is playing the advance man.
Gentlemen, we've run out of time, and very rarely do we end on a positive note. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in New York. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR. CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.